Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Dakota Life airs tonight on SDPB-TV. That's at 7 Central, 6 Mountain. This evening, Melissa Hammersmith-Severs, Bob Bussey, and Brian Gevick tell stories about interesting South Dakota people, places, and events. Tonight's episode includes World War II aircraft, potatoes kept in pockets, hunting and trapping, and Chislic. Producers Melissa and Bob join us from SDPB's Vermilion Studio. Melissa, hey, how's it going?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Bob, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
And joining us in the Sioux Falls studio, SDPB's Brian Gevick. Hey, Brian.
Hey, great to be here.
All right. I want to start with the Doolittle Raiders, Bob Bussey, because this was a story that John Mollison came and told us before it happened. And you got to go see everything happen in up close and personal. This is the raid across South Dakota. Give us an idea of just how really kind of impressive this event was in South Dakota, and then let's talk a little bit about the history of it.
Right, it was a very impressive event. It was in commemoration of the Doolittle Raid, which happened in April of 1942. So this was the 77th anniversary of the Doolittle Raid, and there were two South Dakotans were involved in the Doolittle Raid. Of course, that's a very famous raid from World War II, which kind of boosted the morale of the American military and helped us continue on with World War II. So what they did is they brought an actual B-24 bomber, which was most everything on this plane was authentic. You know, I asked one of the people about what's been upgraded, and he said, well, we have GPS and a couple of little, you know, things that you legally have to fly a plane now, but everything else is authentic. And they went from Sioux Falls to Mitchell to Pierre to Rapid City. And Michael Zimney, our associate producer, and I got to fly in Rapid City.
All right. When we talk about, you mentioned the morale boost that America needed during World War II, this is a very high risk, well-planned, but very risky morale boost, because this is a raid on the mainland of Japan. Tell us a little bit about the history of the Doolittle Raiders.
Well, and see, this happened in April of 1942, so which is only, 5 months after Pearl Harbor. At that time, between Pearl Harbor and then, the Japanese had been making advances all across the Pacific, and there was, Americans were wondering what happens to us. The Japanese are really on a roll here. And the answer was, we need to show them that we can bomb mainland Japan. It wasn't commonly considered a thing that we could do because of distance at the time, and we didn't have planes that could fly that far, and where would they land, and the whole bit. So they went to James Doolittle, and he put together, I think there was 17, 18 bombers, B-24s. They trained for a couple of months to get ready for this thing. The idea was that they would fly over Japan, drop bombs, make that statement, and then they were going to have to ditch their planes on mainland China.
Wow.
There were 80 people involved. Two of them were South Dakotans. And they ditched their planes in China. It was a successful raid. All but three people made it out alive. And it made that statement that, yes, the U.S. can reach Japan and we can fight back, and that was a great statement for the American public, and it was also a demoralizer, I guess you would say, for the Japanese.
Right. All right. So we have an audio clip, and when you mentioned two South Dakotans on this trip, set this clip up for us, because it's a little bit about why South Dakota matters in this story.
Well, so this raid was to highlight the fact that South Dakota did have two people took part in the Doolittle Raid. And one of the people we talked to was Kim Morey. He is president of the South Dakota Air and Space Museum. They are the group who was the primary group that put this event together. And he talked a little bit about South Dakota's involvement in the war.
South Dakota has, for some reason, it's just chance, I suppose, but when there has been an important event in military aviation, there seems to have been an outsized proportion of South Dakotans involved. In the Doolittle Raid, there were 80 persons that ended up being selected to go on the raid. Two of those were from South Dakota. And in World War II, South Dakota was a little bit less than 1/40th of the population of the United States, like quite a bit. So South Dakotans were a significant part.
So Bob, you got to fly on this plane and sort of and meet the pilots and experience some of this up close and personal. You've done a fair amount of flying yourself. So when you looked at when you looked at some of the, you know, the instruments, the, you know, what they had access to, what they didn't have access to, what
1940s era navigation and communication and, you know, flight controls and everything. It was really something. It was really a big history lesson. What struck me is we know these bombers are we see pictures of them and think they're really large. It's really a cramped thing when you are on these things. You know, it was tight for all of us getting on there, and there was like, I don't know, four or five of us got to take the ride. Yeah. But anybody that was on there, it's a loud experience. The engines are just deafening. It's a cramped experience. Everything is very what we would consider crude by today's standards. You know, you're sitting on wood benches and surrounded by bare metal, and it was just quite an experience. But it really gives you an appreciation for, you know, we did this on a beautiful day in Rapid City, a friendly event, and we were, you know, flying over the Black Hills. What must it have been like for the Doolittle Raiders, who this raid happened at night, and they knew that they were going to have to bail out at the end of this thing? Right. It just boggles the mind how the bravery that these guys had.
Nobody's shooting at you that day. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, wow. All right. Let's talk with Melissa Hammersma Sievers, because from the Doolittle Raiders, also this episode of Dakota Life features some stories about Little South Dakota ag history. So tell us about the Hall Century Farm, which has been, tell us a little bit about this farm.
Yeah, Roy and Flora Hall purchased their farm near Wagner in 1919, and this past August, at the South Dakota State Fair, they received their Century Farm commemoration.
Okay.
And it's cool because, you know, history can be reflected in a variety of ways, and, you know, the history of your ancestors, you know, even just, you know, a generation or two ago, can kind of help shape your path, and you know, it definitely shapes where you come from. And so I got to go visit with three ladies of the Hall family who they've collected a lot of fond memories on this piece of property, and two generations have lived on it, and then the third grew up in Wagner but spent a lot of time visiting with her Uncle Willie, who never married or had children of his own, but the children of his brother Dale were like his own, and so they've got a lot of memories with him.
All right, we got to talk a little bit more about Willie, because he's something of a character. He likes to collect hammers,
right,
and hammers are all different, and they are too. I mean, look at the labels; those are not the same hammers. He cared enough to pay attention to the differences and the nuances of the hammer.
Yes,
yeah,
He appreciated old things, and Jan Kokish's husband joined the family farm, and he kind of helped update his father-in-law and uncle-in-law to modern ways of farming, but they were ones to kind of do things the old way, and they appreciated the mechanics of old equipment. And Marjorie Hall, who would be Willie's sister-in-law, you know, she thought that the nail puller was always something, but they appreciated, you know, even though they didn't know what each style of hammer was, you know, they appreciated that Willie knew and took the time to archive.
Yeah. And we're going to hear a little story here about Willie and another little quirk that he had. Let's play that.
He used to put a small potato in his pocket and carry it around, and because someone had told him that it helps with the arthritis or injured joints. And when it got hard, then he would put a new potato in there.
And they still have some of those potatoes like the original potatoes.
Yeah, they yeah, brought them out and showed them to me, and they look like little rocks.
Little rocks, and the original Willie's potatoes. Yeah.
Yep. And when Willie was done with one, he'd set it up on the windowsill and get another new potato, and it must have worked.
Yeah.
He lived to be, you know, 92 years old. He passed away in the spring, but then the fall before, he was still helping to drive the grain carts to town for.
Right. So he was working really in his 90s. So clearly his arthritis yes. was potato aided.
I think it's something to look into.
I think it is. I think it is too. I was thinking you maybe would have to heat the potato up, that it was like a heat thing, but I think he just carried it.
Well, that's if you're hungry.
That's your lunch, right?
Yeah.
Brian Gevick is with us here in the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls, and this is the King of the Wolfers segment. We've had a conversation before about this on Images of the Past, but even though I was part of that conversation when I was watching King of the Wolfers, I was still riveted by the Dakota Life version because of all the visual elements to it.
Yeah, yeah. Matt Klassen, who is the King of the Wolfers from the Faith area, has a daughter. And she's 96 years old now. She kept a lot of these old pictures, and they're featured in the video that people are going to see tonight. Irene lives in Faith still. It's about 7 miles from where her parents lived and where she was born. She wrote a book about her dad because she feels like he deserves to have his story told, and she wants people to know what kind of man he was, and she also wants people to try to understand how people at the time, way back when, were feeling about wolves and these other predators that were killing their cattle and their sheep and their horses.
Dad was a real mild man. You would have never thought that he could have went out and killed wolves like he did. And people didn't realize how desperately they needed his help, that the wolves were increasing and really destroying livestock.
What a treat that you got to sit with
yeah.
her.
Oh,
that
yeah.
was just such a, you must feel a great sense of gratitude.
Very much so. Yeah, to be able to connect with someone connected to those days. And what's kind of remarkable about this to me is that those days are not that long ago.
Right.
And Matt Klassen was being paid by the federal government. He was being paid by ranchers. His job for about 13, 14 years was bluntly killing wolves and killing coyotes and so on. And we can look at that in, you know, today's light and say, oh, you know, but, you know, you have to try to understand the mindset of if this were your colt that you were, you know, raising up to be a pleasure horse or even a working horse, or if you had a lot of cattle that were being killed or injured, it was costing you money and you were not necessarily thinking very much about whether there would ever not be wolves in the territory.
Right, and the things we understand now about the ecosystem.
Yeah.
Maybe we didn't understand clearly because of the way the buffalo were decimated and which caused the wolves to go after. There's a whole lot happening there that really wasn't fully understood.
That's true.
Until, you know, decades later.
Yeah, that's true. And there are still wolves that pass through from the more established packs. There are packs in Wisconsin and Minnesota, Wyoming, that have been, you know, released into Yellowstone Park, and now they've set up territories outside the park. So in some areas, they're going through, you know, what they were going through 100 years ago. They're mm-hmm. they're revisiting that, where they've got livestock predation. And there are still people who have Matt Klassen's job to go out and kill wolves when they have become problematic.
Yeah. So much about Dakota Life, Melissa, is really about honoring those stories of who we are and our history. And sometimes you get to tie it into some quirky sort of current popular things, such as Chislik. So a little bit in Dakota Life's about the history of Chislik. Tell us how far, what is Chislik? This is just meat on a stick.
Yeah.
Everybody has meat on a stick, right?
Right. And that's the great thing about our history and culture. Sometimes, you know, it's often reflected on our food. You know, the Norwegians have lutefisk and lefse. Chislik is indeed meat on a stick. We visited with Marnette Hofer, the director of the Heritage Hall Museum in Freeman, and she points out that meat on a stick is part of a lot of ethnic foods, And the subtleties come kind of in how it's prepared. Chislik came with the Germans from Russia, and they didn't bring it with them directly. You know, they were still part of, like, sausages and that style of food. But their interactions with the Tatars that lived in what we know now as the Crimean region exposed them to something called shashlik. And that's the version of food that Marnette's been researching. Mm-hmm. And the way that it's prepared is a little bit different.
So shashlik, they grill their meat on coals. Traditionally there it is lamb, because these were often Muslims that were cooking it. They often, it depended on the area and availability to resources, but oftentimes they marinated their lamb and had various seasonings. Again, that differs with the region. And then when they serve it, they have flatbread and they pull it off of those spears with the flatbread.
To be a South Dakota nosh.
Yes. Yep. So it's evolved. And you'll hear in the segment how Chislik has evolved. It's still lamb, but even the type of meat's evolving. There's still some similarities. You know, there's saltine crackers in place of flatbread. And instead of spears that look like swords, they're little bamboo skewers commonly. But there are some other adaptations that have been taking place. And I think that Chislik as the state nosh is still evolving a bit too.
And she mentions in the segment, this is a social event. Chislik can be, and it still kind of is a social event.
Yeah, they
a social out, media event even.
Yeah. And they pointed out that people don't get as excited about grilling out hamburgers. You know, although some people might beg to differ, you know, you have your friends in the backyard. But a few people that we visited with said, you know, homecomings, family reunions, they often turn to a Chislik fry to feed a lot of people quickly.
All right. Well, you can see tonight's Dakota Life, all these stories, plus the video footage, the maps, the photos. It's just a really great visual treat. So tune in to SDPB TV tonight. That is at 8 Central. I misspoke earlier. 8 Central, 7 Mountain. Melissa, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having us.
Bob Bussey, thanks as well.
Thanks, Lori.
Brian Gevick, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Lori.